Regulated and Relational, the bi-monthly podcast produced by the Attachment and Trauma Network. Ginger and Julie are in the studio today with Connie Persick, a speech-language pathologist and educational consultant and founder of Supportive Solutions. She's come to teach us about interoception, a very important hidden sense that we all have. Let's join them now.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to Regulated and Relational, a podcast produced by the Attachment and Trauma Network. I'm Ginger Healy.
And I'm Julie Beam.
And we're excited to share with you from both our personal experiences and our professional knowledge what it truly means to be attachment-focused, trauma-informed, and how we can help children impacted by early childhood trauma. We love inviting experts as guests on our podcast, and today we are so excited to welcome a good friend of ATN's, Connie Persick. Welcome, Connie.
Hi, thank you for having me.
We're so glad you're here. Connie is an expert on the topic of interoception, one of our hidden senses, the ability to process information from inside our bodies that affects our behavior, health, and well-being. I'm just really excited to talk about this today. Before we do, Julie, will you tell everybody about Connie?
Of course, I would love to. Connie Persick is a highly experienced speech-language pathologist and educational consultant. She has more than 20 years of experience in the educational setting and holds certificates in instructional coaching, positive education, and applied educational neuroscience. She served as a member of a multi-state work group that helped to develop the Common Core Essential Elements for English Language Arts. Connie is a published writer for Autism Parenting Magazine, and she writes for Exceptional Needs Today and is a guest blogger over at our friends at the Alliance Against Seclusion and Restraint. She created an innovative process to assess student behavior, which deviates from the traditional behaviorism approach and aligns with current relational and neuroscience while maintaining a trauma-sensitive and neurodiversity approach. Connie works from the guided mission that connection plus collaboration equals endless possibilities. That's fantastic. That's a fantastic mission. Connie, just give us a little bit of background of what has led you to where you are today professionally.
Oh, geez. So, well, I grew up in a family with, there were four of us. One of my sisters has cerebral palsy. So we were always just, I mean, most of us have become helpers, like in the field of helping other people. Mm-hmm. So I think that kind of led me down my path to become a speech language pathologist. And then I just say I was really lucky. My first job was at a school for kids with autism. Most of those students had significant behavioral needs where the school district couldn't service them or feel like they could meet their needs adequately. So they sent them to our school. And our mission was really to just give them those foundational skills to help them get back to their home school and their home environment as quickly as possible. And it was just such a positive experience. I just fell in love with trying to figure out the root cause of behaviors and supporting students who might be exhibiting behaviors. And it just kind of led from there. Every job that I took after that, I sometimes joke with my colleagues that it was hard to find a job to replace that because it was such a positive experience. You know, I had an occupational therapist, a speech, myself as a speech therapist, a teacher, and we all co-taught together and just provided a really good environment for our students. And every job that I took after that was either supporting teachers or supporting students or both around behaviors in the schools. And so we just kind of continually focused on that. And about 10 years ago, I had my daughter and I wanted to try and find a little bit more work-home balance once I had her. And then I started my own business where I started getting calls from people who knew me, from districts that knew me, to help them problem solve situations around students that were potentially struggling, teams that wanted help. And that's just expanded over the last 10 years. So
I think what I want to know twofold, because your business that you do now in talking about supporting teens at school and others, I think a lot of our listeners may not know what interoception is and why they need to know about it. Because I also really want to know what that looks like when you go into a classroom, when you go into a school, and what that looks like, what you do, how you help, And so that wasn't a very good way of asking that. I just want to know all about interoception and then what you do on your end. That fascinates me.
Yeah, it's a topic that's being talked about more and more. I want to say since 2019, it's become just something people are talking about and more aware of. And so there's still a lot of people in the educational system that don't know what it is. So it definitely is something that I'm oftentimes suggesting and recommending to teams and helping get them more knowledge around the topic so we can meet students where they're at. Because if you don't have a solid foundation in interception, you can't self-regulate if you don't have interceptive abilities. It's going to be really difficult to do so, I guess I should say. It's the foundation of self-regulation. And so we need to back up sometimes and go back to the foundational skills that are needed.
Good. Okay. So tell us that. Go back to that foundation and kind of tell us what it looks like, what it is. Give us examples of interception.
Sure. So interception is another sensory system, you know, just like what we hear and what we see. It helps us answer the question, how am I feeling right now and what do I need? And so really it's about those internal sensations that we have, noticing them, not just noticing them, but attributing those to emotional states or bodily states, I guess I call that. So noticing that my stomach is growling, attributing that to, oh, I'm hungry, or noticing that my heart might be beating really fast, my mouth might be dry, my neck is tight and feeling clenched, that means I'm feeling anxious. For me, that means I'm feeling anxious. For you, you might experience anxiety in a very different way. But becoming more self-aware about those sensations and then attributing meaning to those. And it's really, like I said, the foundational skill needed for self-awareness and for self-regulation.
I guess my question would be to talk a little bit about what goes wrong when your system isn't doing those things, right? Because you mentioned that interception is like a foundational building block for self-regulation, which of course we've talked about a number of times on this podcast called Regulated and Relational, about how important it is to help our children be able to regulate. But if they don't have that foundational block, first of all, why don't they? What could be causing that? Then we can obviously talk about what we should do about it.
Well, I think the research is pretty clear that autistic individuals have less awareness of their interoception. Mm-hmm. And then also people who've experienced trauma are going to be less aware of their sensations and their bodily states also. But I also think I'm trying to be much more neurodiversity affirming in the way I look at things versus, mm-hmm. you know, this medical model and saying something's wrong with someone's interoception. Instead, I think we all have a range of ability and there's natural variations in all of our sensory systems. And that's the same thing with interoception. So some people might have a really hypersensitive awareness of their internal body sensations. They might notice the smallest little sensation that's really sensitive to them. And then other people on the opposite end of the range might have this hypoawareness and it takes a lot of a sensation for them to feel it. Just like with hearing, you know, mm-hmm. some people might be really sensitive, hypersensitive to sound, and some people might be hyposensitive to sound. Right. It takes a much louder right. noise to do that. So I think it's about becoming aware of where on that range you are, and then trying to learn more about your body, learn more about how you're experiencing different emotions and bodily states. I definitely think people who have a more hypersensitive interception tend to have more anxiety because they're noticing everything. They tend to be more self-aware also, which is a big mm-hmm. strength. And then people who don't notice their internal sensations are going to have just a little bit more difficulty self-regulating and being able to be aware of what their body needs. Mm-hmm. And so I try to approach it from really taking a deep dive into where that student is now. I love Kelly Mahler's assessment of interoception, her comprehensive assessment of interoception. And the third edition is great. It just came out in September. I use that often when I'm trying to evaluate where a student is within their interoceptive abilities. What makes it even more confusing is, for instance, I just evaluated a little girl. You know, she had really good awareness of her sensations around hunger, around thirst, around pain. And she could notice those sensations, attribute those to those bodily states, but not for sleep and energy. She had a really hard time noticing her sensations when it came to sleep. That assessment, Kelly Mueller's assessment, breaks that down for you. So within yourself, you can have a range of interoceptive abilities also. So that's important to note. For individual students, I tend to start there if I want to work on interoception, and then we can kind of have more targeted intervention around what they potentially need to develop more awareness around. But overall, I can talk a little bit more about overall within the classroom too, what I try to do to support this.
I just think that I know we don't do this enough, talk about feelings and sensations and what's going on. I think we take it for granted, or we just assume that, like, you know when it's time to go to the bathroom, you know when it's time to stop eating, you know if you need to wear a sweatshirt because you're cold. Like, some people just think that those things come automatically, and that when you feel a certain way, you've solved that problem by doing this. But the truth of the matter is that's not the case. And you mentioned neurodivergent students, you mentioned students impacted by trauma. It just doesn't come naturally to them. So I love that we have to really, you know, explicitly sit down and guide and model this for students. I love that we're talking about this, because it wasn't certainly something that I grew up talking about.
And I think we have a tendency to jump to, like, navigate. How do we teach a student to navigate their emotions, navigate their bodily states? You know, if they're dysregulated, what strategies will help them get regulated? But we forget the prerequisites. So I often tell teachers, you know, think about this, the saying, notice, name, navigate, because that will help you know the way to teach the skill. Because oftentimes what I'm seeing is educators jumping to navigate when the students don't have the ability to notice their sensations, attribute those to an emotion and name that emotion or a bodily state and name that bodily state. And then once we can do that, we can learn how to navigate, because we really truly can't get what we need if we can't explicitly name what it is we're struggling with, or a feeling we're having, or, you know.
Yeah. And I think the other thing I really liked what you said, Connie, was about normalizing all of this. And because I'm thinking about myself as a young child and the way my sensory system was different than my siblings or some of my friends. And no one at that age ever explained that to me. It wasn't until I had a child who had some significant sensory issues of all kinds that I even began exploring down this pathway. And yet, there is a reason that my sister twirls her hair and that I have trouble recognizing certain painful things that happen to me and all of these things. And it's not a disorder or a disability. It's just the difference in your nervous system. And nobody ever named that for me or gave me permission to think about how to address that, how to really dig in and learn. You know, I think it's fantastic that your work and others' work is doing exactly that.
Yeah. I'm really trying to work hard at moving away from, ooh, you have, you know, deficit in your interoceptive abilities. This is a description of where you are now. And if we can help you become more aware, that's great. There's no right or wrong way to feel or right sensation. You know, I'm seeing more and more visuals that kind of lump sensational words into, okay, so a fast heart, a tight muscles in your neck, sweating, those are all sensation words that kind of tend to be what we associate with anxiety. But I think there's a real danger to doing that and categorizing those sensations, especially for our neurodivergent learners, because we all experience the world differently and our body communicates to us in a very different way. So there's no right or wrong sensation for a particular emotion or right and wrong sensation for a particular bodily state. And everybody experiences that very differently. And so we have to be careful with that messaging too, because I think sometimes we unintentionally send this message that these sensations are the typical ones or the ones that we're supposed to be feeling when it comes to this particular emotion. Right. And, you know, too many of our self-advocates now are coming out and telling us, you know, that's not the way I feel anxiety. My body is totally different. So I might have a fast heart and get hot or get sweaty and my neck might get tight, but you might feel heavy and hot and fatigued, and that's okay. There's no wrong sensation. There's no wrong way of feeling. So that's the first thing we have to really consider when we're teaching these, because our world is way too diverse to just assume that everybody is feeling things in the same way and that their body is communicating to them in the same way.
Oh, that's so good, because how many oftentimes then is there a misdiagnosis and a treatment plan that doesn't work? It's ineffective because, yeah, it wasn't anxiety maybe, but because we, you know, attributed certain sensations and symptoms to it. Yeah. And I like the idea of empowering the person to notice it within themselves so that they can have an individualized treatment plan, you know, and be able to kind of look at healing themselves rather than being dependent on a checklist or, you know, anything like that.
Yeah. So I tell people, you know, one of the best things to do in the classroom when you're trying to teach students to just be more interoceptive aware is to model it within yourself. You know, Kelly Mahler uses the term interoceptive talk. And so start using interoceptive talk about yourself. Like, wow, I noticed my stomach is growling. I need to go get some food. Or, wow, my hands are really sweaty. I need to take something, a layer off. Start modeling that thinking for your students and that vocabulary for them. We've known for a really long time that that's the best way to teach social emotional skills is to model it within ourselves. And so starting to have some of those modeling, that type of talk in your classroom is really great. There's a lot of books out there, children's books that talk about sensations and talk about how their body feels. So I would be doing a lot of that and read alouds. And I have a whole text set around interoception on my website that people can jump over and grab. And it, I have one for adults if they want to learn more about the concept, but also one for students where you can read books to them to model that vocabulary, have those discussions with your students and just expose them to some of those concepts. And then, you know, because I'm a speech pathologist, I always want to start trying to teach some of the vocabulary because some of our students don't have the vocabulary to be able to describe what they're feeling. So we definitely need to be teaching some of that vocabulary also. And I have an image on my website for like a vocabulary list of different sensation words. Kelly Mahler has great cards for that. And so starting to expose students to those words also really, really helps. Also just doing frequent emotional check-ins within your classroom. So, hey, how are you feeling? Where do you feel that in your body? And again, there's no right or wrong. I mean, I've had some kids feel anger in their entire body. Some kids feel it in their stomach. Some kids have colored in their feet. And so everybody's going to experience that emotion differently, but being able to just take a pause, notice what you're feeling and where you're feeling it is really important. And then probably most importantly is just moving away from some of those compliance-based approaches, because I think compliance-based approaches really teach learners to ignore what their internal body sensations are telling them so that they can please another person. And, you know, I always tell this story about my daughter who has a 504 plan because she actually has a dysfunction of her autonomic nervous system. She has POTS. And if she gets overheated, she is a more likelihood of fainting. And so the rule at school is if you go out with your jacket on, you have to keep your jacket on. I think they've since changed that, but it used to be the rule. I do want to give them credit. She's in fourth grade now. They've gotten rid of that rule. But in kindergarten, that was the school rule. And I had to write in her 504, her accommodation plan. You know, if Addison gets hot outside, she needs to learn to trust her body and know what it needs. That's how you survive with a chronic condition, and she can take her jacket off. But then, you know, I'll go and observe in schools and I'll see the little boys with sweat dripping down their upper lip and their jacket tied to their waist. And then they get in trouble for taking their jacket off because that was the rule that they shouldn't do. So we're teaching, we're sending, again, it's not intentional. It's an unintended message that ignore what your body is telling you so that you can please the adults around you. And that's a pretty dangerous, dangerous message to send.
I was just thinking about that whole bathroom thing, that there are only certain times of the day that you can go to the bathroom, you know, like as a student myself, and then watching my children go through that. I understand why you have rules like that in a school with so many children, and it works schedule wise, but at the same time, we have to be really careful.
Yeah, there should be no shame and blame for going to the bathroom.
Right. Or anything that, you know, you're feeling or that your body is trying to tell you. But I'm thinking, you know, Connie, I'm thinking about that story about the jacket and thinking, you know, is it that we're just trying so hard to teach children to be responsible and to plan ahead? And, you know, those are executive functioning skills that don't even come online fully until adulthood. It's like,
well, it's probably even more practical than that. It's, I don't want Johnny to accidentally leave his coat on the playground, and I don't want to be responsible for 26 coats. The practicality of that. But at the same time, you know, it's like, could we make a pile of coats and then take the, you know, 30 seconds to a minute to grab your coat as you're going back in the building, that type
of thing. Right. Just provide a reminder. Everybody go check where the coats are. Make sure you didn't forget yours. Right. I agree with you, Julie. I do think it's for practical reasons that those kind of rules are implemented because, whoa, what if we've got like 20 different coats all over the playground? But if we think about it differently, we can teach a different procedure and a different routine. Like if you need to take your coat off, this is where the coats go. And, and then we have to remember to check that pile before we walk in, so we're not leaving our materials outside.
Yes.
And I think, you know, you just being able to come in maybe to a team and say, have you tried this? What about this? Because so often I met with a school last week when I was suggesting changes, it was like, but we've always done it this way, or this is how we do it. Like, it was like almost a fear of, but if we change, it's going to result in chaos. It's not going to work, you know? And so I like that you're suggesting you actually can do it. And here's how, here are a couple of ways, give it a try, because the consequences could really be harmful to a child.
Right. The unintended negative consequences, I think, are really outweigh the positives in some of those scenarios. And we have to start thinking about that more and what we are asking kids to do. And also, you know, we have this tendency, we all grew up this way, and we have this tendency of dismissing children when they have feelings and emotions, especially big feelings. And that's something else that I think we can change to build a more like introspective, aware environment, basically, because if we dismiss somebody who's having a feeling, I was just in a classroom, a little boy was growling, he was hitting the manipulatives that he had to work with for math. And the teacher, instead of acknowledging those feelings, she said, you don't need to be mad. There's no reason to be mad. You just need to follow directions. So that's a dismissal, right? And I mean, most people don't even know they're doing it. It's just kind of how we have been raised. It's only until very recently that we're talking more about, let's make sure we send the message that all feelings are okay, and let's acknowledge and let's empathize. So again, I don't think it was intentionally done to that child to be negative, but it's done. And then that makes somebody second guess their internal experience. And so it does that. It makes you kind of think, I shouldn't be mad. Why am I feeling this way? And start second guessing those sensations and those emotions. But it also, Susan Davis talks about this a lot. As humans, if somebody dismisses your emotion, you just feel like you have to prove that emotion more strongly. So it actually escalates the situation. The student is thinking, no, I really am mad. I'm going to show you that I'm mad. Right. But it doesn't do anything to teach introspective skills. Right.
And it harms all the relationship and that felt safety too, because the adult doesn't see me, doesn't understand what I'm trying to communicate. And so I either have to like lash out and make this bigger, or I, you know, make myself smaller and push.
Retreat.
You know,
retreat.
Right. I feel invalidated and I'm like, well, something must be wrong with me. Am I really feeling the way I'm feeling?
Exactly.
And so we don't want somebody to start second guessing their internal experiences. And so we have to acknowledge that. So instead, in that situation, I gave the suggestion, we could say, I hear you're growling. I see you're hitting. I wonder what you could be feeling. Mm-hmm. And prompt that with curiosity. Like, okay, so what are you feeling? I notice you're doing these two things. I wonder what is wrong. And see what the student can do and say. A lot of neurodivergent individuals say not to label an emotion for somebody because, you know, we might be very wrong. Right. And especially neurodivergent learners, they might not have the self-awareness to correct you. And that can be super confusing to them. But I try to tend to open with curiosity. And then if my student isn't able to respond, then I'm like, I wonder if you're feeling frustrated. Because some of our students just don't have the vocabulary to be able to tell us that. Mm-hmm. And so I want to try to model that. But I always try to stop and open that with curiosity first, because they might tell me, I'm not frustrated, I'm mad. Or I might be thinking they're frustrated, but to them, they might be just mad. And so I think it's important to start with some curiosity, and then depending on your student, model. And I think that just has to be a very individual decision for the team, but maybe perhaps model what those sensations and those behaviors are attributed to.
Curiosity is so important. We talk about it all the time.
It's my favorite.
Yeah, it really is. It just helps in so many different ways. And I notice with one of my kids, I can always tell, of course, when, not of course, but I can tell when he's not himself and something's going on. But when I ask, you know, what's going on, what's happened, 99% of the time he'll say, I don't know. And so that curiosity piece really helps. And for him, sometimes I do need to give a suggestion, like, I'm wondering if, because that's a powerful statement, because it gives the opportunity to either be a yes or a no. Like, it doesn't put anything solidly in place. It just opens the door and gets him thinking too. You know, like this morning we were headed out the door and he just could not find his words. And I was probably talking too much, right? He was just not processing quickly. And every time I'd ask him a question, it was, I don't know. And so I'd offer a lot of suggestions and none of them were sitting right or feeling right. But at the end, he kind of came around after a while, and it was just that he needed me to be attuned, that he needed something. Well, that we ever got to the exact thing, it was just that he needed me right by his side to walk through this until he got to the other side, you know, because what ended up solving the problem, really, I thought about it later and reflected, it wasn't that exact intervention. It was just the whole of, well, I'm still here. Well, let's try this, you know, and the time getting through it. But being curious and offering him suggestions and not walking away, because there are times when I'm just, you know, you kind of are like, well, figure it out. Let me know when you're ready, you know, because we're exhausted, but just that, okay, well, that didn't work. Let's try something else, you know.
If we can model some of that curiosity for them, hopefully we can start getting them to become curious too, you know.
Yeah.
Even my daughter right now is really struggling, and I keep saying, I wonder if maybe you're feeling this way. Do you think you're feeling this way? And I'm not sure she knows how she's feeling, but hopefully modeling that will get her to start having that own internal dialogue, you know?
Right.
Yeah, exactly. Because he truly didn't know, but it allowed him the option to explore, so that all of a sudden when it was felt right, you know, when it was like, oh, that does feel different, you know, he can recognize that rather than just pushing through and persevering and being gritty. You know, I didn't want that. I wanted him to know that, you know, this is a moment and we'll get through it. But sometimes we don't know why or how or what. We have to just, I don't know, be there.
The thing that's interesting to me about curiosity, there's a lot of things, and we're going to actually podcast on the topic of curiosity soon. But I'm just wondering, from your experience, Connie, how easily or how hard is it for the adults, for the educators and the caregivers that you interact with, to become curious? What are our obstacles there? That piece isn't really taught or come naturally to a lot of us anyway. It's like, I don't know if you've got some ideas on what we can do to make ourselves more curious or to get around whatever the barriers are that keep us from being curious.
Yeah, it's interesting. I do think it is a struggle for a lot of people, and I'm noticing it even more and more this year. And so I don't know if that's stress. I don't know what that is about the barrier. I do notice it though. What I'm noticing is the people who don't get curious are the people who feel hopeless. And so I'm trying to approach it from that perspective for teams and for teachers, because I've just seen a very clear pattern this year in particular. You know, that boy who was brawling and that boy who was like hitting his manipulatives, if we don't get curious as to why, as a teacher, we feel like we have no control over that situation. We just become hopeless. Mm-hmm. Like, he just won't do it. He just won't do it. He won't behave. And no wonder why we have people like fleeing the profession, because that is a really, really bad feeling. And so I'm trying to show people that just by changing your language, you open up a whole new possibility of interventions. And so if we start asking why, and we start trying to get curious about the behavior that we're seeing, there's a whole slew of different possibilities that we can provide for that student. I mean, potentially isn't that the right one. We might have to do some trial and error. Yes. But at least we're getting possibilities.
Right.
And it's much better than feeling hopeless, because right. over time, that feeling of hopelessness creates anxiety and depression in people. And so, like, I'm just seeing a really clear link to that when it comes to teachers' mental health and teachers leaving the field, this lack of ability to become curious. And so it's definitely correlated, I think. You have much more internal locus of control if you can get curious. And that's going to help your emotional health. It's going to help your well-being. It's going to help the student. I'm trying to approach it from that perspective too for staff. I'm going to be sharing it on Facebook soon. I started creating visuals about getting curious because I just got motivated by some of the language that I was hearing in schools. Like, he won't write. And if you stop with he won't write, you're left with basically not much to do except trying to make him.
Right.
And then that doesn't work.
As opposed to, if you're curious, you recognize that in the moment he can't do that, but I wonder why, right?
Right. Why? Maybe his perception is that writing's really hard. Maybe he has troubles with fine motor skills. And then, like, map that out to, wow, this just added a whole new bunch of possibilities for interventions and supports and accommodations that we didn't have before. I don't know if that's a time thing. It's just a shift in thinking that we're not talking about. You know, again, this is a system error. We don't give teachers very much time to reflect on their language, to reflect on behavior, but we give them plenty of time to reflect on, you know, test scores and academics and where students might be struggling or learning or not learning academically, but we don't build in much time for that, for them to think about it in other areas.
Mm-hmm.
And without reflection, it's hard to become even aware that you're doing it. So,
right. Or change.
And if you know you're not going to have that time to reflect and to really then refine the act of change, like to Ginger's example of telling folks different ways they could do that and getting some resistance and pushback of, well, we've always done it this way, is because they know they're not going to have the reflection time and the thinking about it time to truly finesse that change, right? It's going to be so much more work. Well, on the surface it might be, but, you know, if it solves some of the problems that you're dealing with on a daily basis, it's not much more work at all, but it's hard to be creative. That's my research about curiosity. So in our podcast on curiosity, we'll talk more about that, but you can't be creative if you're not curious. And so, yeah, we're stifling these educators' ability to be creative with how they interact with students when we don't give them that reflection time.
It absolutely stifles creativity. I know we're talking about interception and sensations, but a part of that is attributing it to a feeling or attributing it to a bodily state. So I think that's also an important piece that we forget, is explicitly teaching different feeling words. Because if we can't label things really explicitly, we can't get to what we need. We're going to have better data to be able to ask ourselves, like, what do I need right now to be able to regulate, if we can be more explicit in what we're naming. And so I found that to be really helpful, like feeling families. And so mad is just one word for a mad family, but you can be cranky, which is totally different than mad. You could be irritable. You could be frustrated. All of those kind of fall under the category of mad family words. And there's a range of intensity there. And so I teach the vocabulary, and then I also like map it out intensity wise for students so that they can see, you know, that irritable is totally different than I'm in a rage right now, if that's the word they want to use. And so I think that can be really helpful too, because part of interception is being able to attribute that to a feeling. And we need to have really specific vocabulary for that also, because those words can mean very different things.
Right. Which means that the outcome or the response should be very different, you know? So rather than chasing something that isn't going to be helpful, I love what you do. I have had kind of a sneak peek into some of the documents that you have created that you use in your business and at schools. And Connie, they are so good because they do exactly what you're saying. They give words and they give plans. And for someone like me who needs to see it, I need it kind of concretely in my hands. It's hard for me to come up with it or to really grasp some of these concepts. I love that you have made it really accessible for teachers and students to be able to see a picture of a feeling or to be able to identify what's going on, you know, through colors, through shapes, through, I just love what you have done. And so I hope that, you know, people can reach out to you and your work and use some of these tools and resources and strategies that you have, because
Oh,
they are
thank you.
So powerful.
They
That's
are.
That's really kind of you. Thank you. I really do think the more we can make content visual, the more people can understand it and really grasp what we're trying to tell them.
Especially children. And when we talk about children, we often talk about, you know, chronological age versus developmental age. And so it really speaks to where a child's at. Like, it helps in that process determine and assess where a child is. And for me, at least, I think it takes the shame out of it, because it, oh, I don't know how to say what I'm thinking here, but just that it applies to everybody here. And like, I find it very appealing as an adult, and a child would find it very appealing. You can individualize it. And that's the whole point here, right? Is that everybody's different. And so it helps individualize what this student needs and wants and feels. And it just does it in such a really accessible way. That's what I find about it.
Yeah, and some of the visuals you're talking about, I've used with college students. Huh. Last year, I supported autistic college students. And that was one of the areas they really wanted help with, is interoception. So noticing their internal body states, attributing meaning to that. Visual supports really helped that age group too, because it helped them get the words that maybe they didn't have. And even sometimes I remove the like written word, because maybe they have a word that's better for that feeling than, you know, maybe a different word would speak more to them than the word that everybody else uses. But I had one student in particular that he argued with me the whole semester. He did not believe sensations existed. Like, he was just like, no, I don't believe this. Wow. And I had to like several times say, do you just want me to share some research articles with you? Because he would get into this argument with me, and it was hard to stop the argument. And so sometimes to stop it, I was just like, you know, I think I'm going to just send you some research articles and you can read up on it. Because these were very bright, intelligent college students. And by the end of the semester, what was progress for him was he had this huge aha moment. Like, you know, I think I do have sensations. I just don't notice them until they're really, really big. I think I almost cried in that session because it took a whole semester. Uh-huh. And he was like, I'm just noticing that, you know, by the time I feel stress, it is so big for me. And that's when I start to notice how my body feels. I must be missing some of the more subtle signs. And that was just like a huge self-awareness piece for him.
Yeah.
Because he just didn't believe anything I had to say prior to that. So speaking on individualized, yeah, I mean, like, I do think visual supports help all learners, no matter what mm-hmm. age they are. But also, progress is so individual. For him, that was
yes.
huge, huge progress.
Well, and it speaks to how flexible what you have developed is. Like, you can modify it, for you can put words in, you can take words out, but you've got the visuals. So it's very mm-hmm. adaptable, which is so critical for this population.
Exactly. Yes, I agree. Especially if you want to try to reach all learners, you know, I think we just have to move away from trying to teach to this, I don't know, typical population, which I'm not sure even exists anymore. We're just such a diverse population now. And so we just need to be always thinking, you know, because basically some of these strategies help all learners, just maybe at varying levels.
That is such a great point too, because at the beginning, I even said it myself, you had mentioned neurodivergent learners and those with had experienced trauma. Yes, true, true, true. But we always say that trauma-informed strategies help everybody. And this is where I'm really seeing it, Connie, in your work, is that this works well for everybody. Because when I was telling the story about my son today, this is a son who is neurotypical, but I have been pouring over your stuff, and it was occurring to me some of these pictures and thoughts, and that's what I was exploring with him, and it helped. It worked. Mm-hmm. So it has given me words. It has given me strategies. It's a great work. It will help everybody.
Oh, thanks. My daughter does the same thing. Like, she tells me she has balls in her feet, or she feels like she has balls through her legs. I still don't know what that sensation is. I'm thinking that might be, you know, this is just a good example of why sometimes I remove the words. So maybe that's tingling for her, and that's the mm-hmm. word she uses for it, like balls in my feet. That's the only thing I can think of, is her feet are asleep, but she just feels like it's bigger than just normal tingling. So she has named that. There's balls in my feet. Mm-hmm. And so if I had only taught her tingling meant your foot is asleep, I would be kind of suppressing that expression for her. And so we all experience things differently. We all maybe name things, a different name might resonate with somebody that it doesn't resonate with another person. And if I can get the message across, I think that's okay.
So Connie, as usual, the time goes super fast. We will definitely make sure that Supportable Solutions, your organization's website and contact information, are in the show notes so that both educators and parents can find you and talk with you about the services you have and more about these topics, because they're so crucial to everyone. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us talking through interception and just in general, the reason we need to be curious and full of awareness of neurodiversity and how that impacts the way we all function. You've given me some new things to think about for sure today. And so we really appreciate you being here.
Oh, thank you. It's been really fun. I really enjoyed it. So thanks for having me.
Great. We'll catch you next time, folks. Thanks for listening in.
This has been another episode of Regulated and Relational. Next time, Julie and Ginger will begin their summer series of discussing emotions in the language of human experiences based on Brené Brown's Atlas of the Heart. So next time, the topic is anger. A special thanks to Lorraine Schneider, our editor, and Jill Kramer for donating our music. For more information about the Attachment and Trauma Network, visit our website at attachtrauma.org. Show notes and upcoming episodes will be available on our website and through anchor.fm. I'm Danny Pankratz. Thanks for listening.